You are listening to the What a Word podcast, an interview style podcast where guests bring their unique experiences and insight on culture, life's challenges, and faith. Each episode is seasoned with words which will inspire and encourage. Now here is your host, Ryan Sharp.
I'm in an interesting season. I'm doing a lot more reflecting. I'm a lot more introspective. And even when I read from some of my favorite subject matters, I'm heavier on analysis. I love wrestling with the tensions between themes and subject matters and thoughts. And you will find that when I have conversations with guests, there seems to be, I'm hoping you'll find that there seems to be a method to the madness. I enjoy chopping it up with guests, and I enjoy chopping it up with this guest in particular, my friend Jules. Whenever we were in person, we would cover culture, family, faith, and I enjoyed those conversations. And we took our time. We would talk for hours on end. I won't do that today, though. I promise you. But Jules is a very introspective and insightful brother. He is a committed father and husband. He's a criminal justice professional, and he has good history with culture. And I'll talk to him more about his story, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. Please join me in welcoming my friend Jules to the What a Word podcast. Welcome, Jules.
Thank you. Thank you. What's happening, Ryan?
Good, man. Good to have you, bro. I did some research, found some old pics of you on Facebook, and noticed that you, back in the day, you were very fashionable. I saw polo. I think I may have even seen Jabos, a Carcanai, Guess. I know it's not limited to any of those brands. And you could tell me there was more that I may have missed. But do you find that your own children, our young adults now, older kids, do they believe that you are, as they say, dripping? Do you have the drip according to your kids?
Yeah, according to my son and some of my coworkers that call me OG as well, yeah, I got that drip, as they would say.
Oh, wow. So your kids believe you have the drip?
I just like to be fashionable. You know, I came from the era where, you know, first and foremost, I was raised by two parents that taught me that your parents was everything. Your character was everything. But people watch you from the grooming of your hair to your nails to the cleanliness to your shoes on your feet. So I came from that type of upbringing, first and foremost, before even getting into fashion. But then coming in, growing up into the 70s and the 80s, fashion, more the 80s into the 90s, fashion was everything. That's the first thing that caught my eye as a youth, watching the older fellas and stuff like that. It was the fashion that, you know, drew the females. It was the fashion that made you stand out. So from early, I picked up the early trends of whatever was going on at the time. For me, what would be considered drip is just a normal everyday, you know, just trying to present yourself in a certain way.
And you do casual and formal wear well. Do you have brands that have lasted the test of time?
Mostly Ralph Lauren. Polo Ralph Lauren is the one that I use the most. Only because it's the only thing that still comes in big and tall that looks good. Being that I'm 6'4".
Gotcha.
270. It's kind of hard to find certain active and regular wear, just everyday wear, to still look good in my size. because as far as my suits and stuff, for my size, I usually have to get everything custom tailored. So from young, I used to be in a part of a crew, a little polo posse in the early 80s. They were originally known as Low Lives. So I was a part of that clique. So I got into Polo Ralph Lauren early. But I find as an adult, it's not that I'm into that anymore. It's just as an adult, the clothes still look good. And the only thing that still comes in big and tall.
Yeah. Makes sense. Jules, how old are your children? And do you find that you see some similarities with them in terms of fashionable expression? Or does their clothing not make sense to you as a parent?
My son is 15. He'll be 16 in 2 weeks. And my daughter is 22. She'll be 23 in January. Both of them are very much into fashion themselves. I don't know if it's something from me or something they just grew up into. Because the funny thing about it, when they were younger, I used to buy them everything that I felt was fashionable for them. And they didn't study it. At one point, I remember either it was my daughter or my son, one of them, I wanted to buy them some Air Max. And at the time, they wanted Vans or Converse. I was like, so it go, you know? So I feel that, you know, they've grown accustomed to trends themselves on their own. They're both very fashionable, especially my son. You know, as young men come up, you know, they start feeling themselves, so. He's definitely one of those that, like, Dad, I gotta have this swag. I gotta have this drip, as they would say in their newfound language.
Yeah, and so much comes full circle because I've looked at pictures of you. I look at pictures of your kids, and your son in particular is even rocking some of the same hairstyles you rocked in the 80s and 90s. You see kind of the full circle coming around. Yeah.
Correct. He's went from the low waves to the high top fade to now, right now, in the twist.
Wow. Yeah. That has 80s and 90s all over it too. Yeah. We didn't get to talk a lot during the heights of the pandemic. What did you experience, you and your family, during, you know, when COVID hit? What was your experience?
I actually came down with COVID in the beginning of the stages in March. The very, very, very beginning. I had actually came back from a trip from Trinidad in February. And that's when everything started. But nobody knew what was really going on. A couple of people that were on the trip with me all came back sick. But they all felt, you know, it was just a basic common flu, common cold. Nobody knew what it was really going on. Even prior to that, it seemed like my son might have had it in December, and we didn't realize it because he had what we thought was the basic cold flu, but then it stayed in his sinus longer than was to be expected, as far as taste and smell and just something really, really nasal that actually lasted for like maybe a month and a half, where we had to send him to get antibiotics twice. But at that time, nobody knew nothing about COVID or anything like that. So we just thinking it was just a basic sinus cold that lasted for a long period of time. By March, I would say I was at work, and that's when, you know, the name COVID and everything had came up to what was going on, and they shut things down at work, so we wasn't really going nowhere. And I think I might have went to the gym with my coworker, and I really like 6 to 8 years because I'm on a high regimen of what everybody's doing right now is something that I was doing prior because I have an early morning tour, so I'm not a big eater. So tea was something I was brought up with as a youth by my parents. So I would put lemon and honey and ginger and apple cider vinegar and all that in my tea prior to COVID. So it was like a normal thing for me. So I think that's what kind of kept my immune system for all the past couple of years. So the day that I was coming home from work after working out with my coworker, I felt the shakes and the chill. That's when I knew something had to be wrong with me, because I hadn't gotten that in a while. So by the time I came home, I let my wife know, you know, I don't know what's going on, but I locked myself in my room and that was that. And come to find out, I did have it.
How bad was it for you, man?
It was terrible, man. I had every single symptom possible. It started from a fever that just wouldn't go away. It would break, come back. And then it went from my there to my nasals. I couldn't eat, uncontrollable hiccups. I couldn't hold down anything at all. But then by the time it hit my lungs, that's when I knew, you know, something was wrong. And that's when I knew it was really, really, really bad, because I could, just to talk to you like I'm talking to you now, I couldn't even say a word to get out of my lungs properly without gasping for air. It was to the point, at one point in time, I actually cried, said a prayer, wrote my will, and called my lawyer and everything else. That's how bad, because I think more time it was at the time, anxiety set in too, from knowing that I think by that time, I think maybe 6 of my coworkers had already passed away from it.
Wow.
And then to see and hear what was going on social media with different people, you know, that's when I guess the anxiety of it and the fear of it is what set in with me, you know. So I prayed earnestly, you know, for God to spare me. I know my family was very upset at the time, especially when I first told them. My wife, kids, all of them cried and stuff. And I just, you know, I'm going to be a daddy, going to be all right. And I just locked myself in the room and locked myself up. And, halfway through, my wife actually forced me to go outside and get some air and start exercising and get back into my normal routine, just to at least try to open up my lungs. And that really, really helped and stuff like that.
Wow. And to the extent you said, you know, you were getting your will prepared and done, which means that you thought this could have been the moment.
Right.
Yeah.
A point in my life, I used to smoke cigarettes. I smoked cigarettes actually for 25 years. I quit maybe like 9-10 years now. I know if I did not have, I thank God that I had quit too.
Mm-hmm.
And because if I still smoked, I don't think I would have been here. But the smoke and what was going on in my lungs would never have mixed.
Yeah. Wow. Well, bro, thankful you made it, man. Really, you know, you live such a life of impact. And like you said, we lost so many that it was just truly grace and mercy, man. And I really am happy that you survived that. Tell listeners a little bit about your parents. What kind of people were they in terms of strict parents?
Very, very strict. Well, my father more than my mother. My mother was lenient, but she was strict. But my father, he ruled by iron thumb, I would say. He was that old-fashioned, do what I say, when I say, and that's it. If not, you know, you got strict discipline. You get licks.
Folks from the islands?
Yeah, my pops is from Barbados. We grew up in Barbados, my mother as well, but they both have Panamanian backgrounds in them from their grands, but they were raised in Barbados.
Your coming of age was in Brooklyn?
Yes. I grew up in Brooklyn and East New York, But I spent every summer in Barbados during the summer. Okay. So it's like half my time was here, half my time was there. So the whole school year was Brooklyn, East New York. And then summers I would spend in Barbados. I think that was more to keep me out of trouble.
So I see pictures in my research with some hip hop legends, among them not limited, but including Notorious B.I.G., Special Ed, Clark Kent, Wyclef. How did, and I know your parents were religious people, church folk, you grew up as a church boy. How did you connect so easily with hip hop culture?
Well, I started, my brother was the first person who ever took me to a club, which was the Underground. The first club I ever went to years ago was the Underground. And at that time, David Levy and Sting Ash and Sting International were the main DJs at that point, at that spot. I wasn't even old enough to be in that spot. It's funny, I was never a hairy person. I actually had to put shoe polish on my mustache to to come in the club, but I had no business being in the club. You know, that was the era where you could get anything from 42nd Street fake. So I had fake ID and everything. I think I maybe was about 16, 17 at the time. Had no business in a grown adult stuff, but that was the first eye opener to me to the club world. My brother took me. I think my parents might have been in the West Indies at the time because they used to go away very frequently. So we would be fending for ourselves most of the time. So, like I said, my brother took me to that. So that's when I was still in touch with my roots, rocks, reggae. As I started going to elementary, that was the era of popping and breakdancing and stuff like that. So I realized I had a talent for that, and I started dancing from early. By high school, I started going to all the different hip hop and, at the time, house music clubs. And that's where all the main dancers in the industry, every single video that you saw on TV, whether it was Video Music Box, MTV, whatever, the main dancers for all artists lied in these same clubs and parties that that I went to. And that's actually how you got handpicked too to dance for people. So I got into dancing and popping and everything else first. I was handpicked to go on the road. Actually, he's my godbrother, but we call each other cousins because we know each other for God knows how long. Chip Foo from the Foo Snickers.
Ah, oh, gotcha.
So when he became an artist, he took me with him. At the time, Pabone was the manager of Foo Snickers and Leaders of the New School. And so we all went on the road together. So at one show, I actually danced with the Leaders of the New School. Buster Rhymes dancer was Geronimo. At one show, I actually did where I performed with him, and then he performed with me and my partner at the time on the stage. So I went from hip hop dancing. I actually had gotten into a job with Video Music Box, their parent company, actually.
Most who don't know, tell them what Video Music Box was for our generation.
Video Music Box was the only video channel, black music video channel at the time that actually played everything that you could see. It was a channel 31 that came on a certain time of the day. And you could see every single hip hop person. This is way before MTV, OMT Raps.
It is like early 80s.
Early 80s. This was way before any of these other venues were playing anything that would relate to us at the time. But wow. That was something that people rushed home to see.
Sure.
That showed you the fashion. It showed you the music. It showed you the clubs, the various dancing, the various dance moves that were out, various artists that were out, everything. So that was like a big thing that related to everybody. From, like I said, from your fashion, from how you dress, to what was the latest song, to what was the latest dance moves and everything else.
So you had bars, Jules?
For me?
Yeah.
I actually...
You had a notebook of rhymes?
Nah, I never was a rapper. I got the opportunity to crowd hype for a show. There was an artist named Black Panther. He was on the New Jersey Drive soundtrack. He was an artist, I forgot what label that he worked for, but he was handpicked by Ralph McDaniels and Mike Burrell to be an artist. He was an intern at the time. And they actually handpicked him. He was a lucky kid. He got handpicked to be an artist. They put together the words, the lyrics, everything for him, the dress, the production, the video, everything for him. He had a song, Do What You Want, Do What You Want. It was a reggae hip hop.
I remember him, man. I remember him.
Right. So he was young. He really wasn't in the streets like that, but I was. And being that I was around his age bracket, but being that I was out there already amongst the hip hop culture and everything else, they paired me off with him and I went on the road with him. And he actually opened up for Biggie in Virginia. And at that show, you know, back then people had crowd hypers and everything else. He didn't have a crowd hyper. I was actually there to choreograph the dances and everything else and help manage them. And I was actually asked to crowd hype on that show. So that's how I ended up opening up that show, crowd hyping on the stage for him, that later opened up for Biggie.
So most people don't understand what a person who is responsible for crowd hype does, but it's more akin to, I think, what we see with Spliff Star and Busta Rhymes.
Correct.
The guy's even finishing your words.
Correct.
Yeah.
The throw your hands in the air, wave them like you just don't care, that type of stuff. You know, hyping up the crowd for the artist. And like you said, finishing off, you know, the words and everything else.
Wow. So I threw something out there about your parents. I made an assumption that they were churchgoers, et cetera. Were both or one more than the other?
They were both. My mother was actually the person that was Adventist. And my father was Brethren when he grew up. But while dating, my mother got my father into Adventism.
Okay.
But my father was not a born Adventist. My mother was.
Did your parents know how much you were into hip hop culture and as a result of that street life?
They knew I liked to dance. They knew I liked hip hop music and stuff like that. My more time I would sneak, because it was unheard of for us to be into stuff like that. But then when they realized it and I started trying to take it more seriously and stuff like that, you know, my pops used to be, you know, that's foolishness. You know what I'm saying? Everything is foolishness. You know what I'm saying? That's getting your books, getting your, you know what I'm saying? Learn your education and stuff like that. But they didn't know what was really, you know, how much of an impact in the world it was starting to happen at the time. You know, so where I could have got into more stuff. I was kind of blocked from doing that. And me and my father used to actually bump heads a lot. He realized that I was changing and I was becoming what he wasn't raising me to be or whatever. So that's where we would clash all the time. And at the time, of course, you growing up in East New York, I grew up Seventh-day Adventist. So Seventh-day Adventist church, Seventh-day Adventist school, XYZ, Pathfinders. That was our only real outlet. So if anything dealing with basketball, everything dealt around the Seventh-day Adventist world. So that was your only real outlet. So other than that, when I wasn't doing that, I was in the streets around my way in East New York. So East New York in the early 80s, and then I went to school everywhere in Flatbush, back and forth. The streets was real back then. So, you know, I kind of started drifting more towards everything else that was going on in the street world. I think around 16, 17, me and my father had a big clash and a big fight. And I ended up leaving home then. And that's when I was more in the streets, because it was like his way or the highway. And I chose the highway. And my stubbornness is what pushed me more to be like, I'm gonna do whatever I gotta do where I ain't gotta come back home. So I did whatever I had to do to come back home, whether it was hustling, boosting, whatever at the time. Things that I had no business doing, but I did a whole leap of stuff at that time. And that's when, it wasn't until my first arrest that my parents realized that.
You were in deep.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, obviously a lot of my listeners are people in the faith community. Some of them have the same setup you described. You know, they are parents working hard, diligent providers. They have children who are being raised in church. How easy is it to get caught up in street life?
It's very easy to get caught up in street life. From my era when we were growing up, people would get teased, clown, you know, jokes. Everything was, that was a part of culture. It's not like what they label everything as bullying nowadays. Like this culture is soft right now. Our culture, that was a part of life. You slap boxed every day, that was a norm. Toe-to-toe in the streets with fellas, that's how you learn to fight, how to mold yourself and everything else. So for me, it wasn't to say that my parents couldn't afford it. Fashion at the time, they just wasn't buying you every and anything like how we buy for our kids nowadays. You know, things were a lot cheaper, but whatever you bought that was name brand and this and that, you better knew how to defend yourself if you bought it to wear. My pops came from a background of, I guess, having one pair of shoes, going to school barefoot and stuff like that. When you're growing up, you don't want to hear, you know, when everybody, and this was the era when everybody was in Pumas and Adidas and Nikes had just came out. So around that time, we're wearing Rejects, Procads, Converse, you know. So once things, you know, what you want to go with the trends of what was going on. So I got my first pair of Pumas. But you had to make these things last for God knows how long. It wasn't, and that one pair literally had to last you literally damn near year, 2 years. You might have grown out of it, but you still had to wear it. You know what I'm saying? If you wanted the thing, because it wasn't like they was running to the store to get you another pair. I was around that time of, you know, I used to ask them for certain things. And after a while, you get tired of hearing the no and the no and the...
We can't afford.
You can't afford and stuff like that. Yeah. The word can't afford never came out their mouth. It was just, do you think money grows on trees? That was the comment. Right. You know what I'm saying? They had a lot going on too. And the thing about it, instead of just relaying certain things, it was just no. You know, parents didn't, like I find I talk to my kids more and let them know certain things rather than just giving them a straight no. Because I realized that was what forced me out into the street. Because it's like, all right, I was raised to be thankful for what I had. Fine, very thankful for what I had. But at the time, like I said, the culture of what was going on, if you didn't have, then you would be the one that looked like the oddball or made to feel like the oddball. And then at the time in our era, to me, that wasn't something to be accepted. So I always have big eyes for big things. So I ended up going out to get what I wanted. So that was, you know, and basically your culture of what was going on in the world and society and time is what made you really feel that you had to have. So, I mean, I realize now that I'm older what they was trying to do and what they were doing, and I'm very appreciative. But at that time in my life, it wasn't something understood. So like I said, it forced me to go do things that I shouldn't have did. You know, I'm never proud of certain things that I've done, but at this age, I'm able to at least share where with somebody else where they could avoid making some of the mistakes that I made and doing some of the things that I've done.
Did you have moments with your parents when you reconciled that you gave them some insight as to, you mentioned the arrest, but other near-death experiences on the streets?
Me and my father, for the time I moved out the house, I hadn't spoken to my father from maybe 18, 19 to maybe till I was about 27. When I had my first child and then when I first had my first legal job. But at that point in time, I actually came to him and apologized for all I had done because I was of age. I was having my first child. I got my first legal job in corrections. And to come into corrections at that time, and I moved to Virginia for corrections to a lifeless penitentiary. So to see, Virginia is very different from New York. It's a Commonwealth community. So they make up laws as they go along. So things that I had gotten slaps on the wrist for here, people were doing major time for there. A nickel bag of weed, you could have got arrested for a nickel bag of weed. There were people doing football numbers for a nickel bag of weed because Virginia's culture, they looked at drugs as the cause of everything. So now, especially if you was from New York and got caught down with a nickel bag, a dime bag of weed at the time, they looked at it as if, all right, we caught you with the nickel, but who's to say this isn't the last of what you originally had prior? So you would get charged with a kingpin charge just for them, because like I said, they looked at drugs as the cause of why people would rape, why people would steal, why people would kill, why everything. So they hit people with bigger numbers for drugs more than anything else. So like I said, to see this firsthand in a life as penitentiary where my first 3 weeks in, a house was coming back from chow, and it was an area of like 200 men, and they were coming back from chow, and I gave my partner like a signal to open up the doors so they can get what they needed for their break. And by the time I turned around, there was a whole crowd in front of a door. And this guy was on top of this guy's back and had his hand clutched around his neck, lifting up his head under a bed rail on the floor, banging his head on the bed rail. But each time that he lifted his neck to bang, he did a circular motion around his neck with a chopper. Jeez. So by the time he finished, the dude had four rings around his neck and three big gas holes in the back of his head. And it's only God's grace that this man didn't die. The guy was trying to decapitate him, basically, prior to me walking up. And the guy got up and walked past me, looked me dead in my eyes, went in his cell, sat down, packed his stuff, lit a cigarette, and was like, you know, call the team. And I'm in awe because I had to ask him, like, you know, what did that do to warrant that? And the guy said to me, I got 110 years. What you gonna do, write me up? I was like, but what did he do? He said, I paid the dude two packs of cigarettes to come in the shower with me. He took my cigarettes, he didn't come in the shower with me. So two packs of cigarettes and a piece of buns, this man was gonna lose his life and get decapitated. This was real jail culture in 97-98 when I first, you know, started correction. That's so simple. So that was a wake-up call to me that, wow, I'm in the real world of what you would say criminality and everything else at the time.
Are you enjoying the What a Word podcast and want to learn how to share it with others on social media? It's easy. Go on your favorite podcast app, find the What a Word podcast, and hit share. Please remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you won't miss any episodes. And if this podcast has encouraged or inspired you, then please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find us easier. Thank you.
So you have a perspective, Jules, of, and you've mentioned the criminal justice perspective. You are now in that entity, seeing things from the other perspective. What, before I get more into that, though, I wanted to ask you, what did you experience? Now, you know, not in your parents' home, raised in church, I'm assuming you got a different picture of grace and mercy being on your own and surviving out there on the streets. Am I correct?
Very much. I was very thankful for being raised the way I was raised in the SDA culture, but just being raised, period, to learn to pray and ask God for whatever. As much as I did wrong, I knew to get back on my knees and ask God for help when I needed it, especially when I needed it. You know, when they say train up a child, and there were ways he should grow in it, and certain things would not depart. I was thankful that I was raised a certain way, because when I was into certain situations, certain things did not depart from me. I knew who I was. I knew how far I would take things when I did things. I still had my morals. I still had certain things of a code, I would say, to myself in the world, but you know, I know the prayers of my mother, and I know the prayers that of my father, and I know the prayers that I prayed for myself is what got me to where I'm at right now.
And what describe for me that gap. You mentioned the 18 years of estrangement or up to with pops. What were those periods like for you?
They were rough. I got into a lot of fights. I got into a lot of incidents. I got into a lot of brushes with the law. I did a lot of things that I wasn't supposed to do. Whether it was in and out of town, as people would say, you got to read between the lines of that. Whatever it took at the time, there's nothing new under the sun. People are into these credit card scams, check scams, whatever it was at the time was functional at the time, put it that way. There's nothing new under the sun.
Wow. So I'll land the plane with this, Jules, and I'll ask you to share your info. Obviously, many may not know, you and I have done the panels in churches already, and you're available for that kind of stuff to share your story and journey. But someone is listening, and just as a cautionary tale for parents who are in that space now where they recognize what your parents may have had a recognition of, that, you know, my child is gradually being drawn away or slipping a bit. Coupled with your regrets, what could you say to a parent, guardian, and in turn, a young person who is in that space where they believe this life, it looks so attractive, it's calling me. And, you know, I'm in that space where, you know, I'm kind of between two opinions at this point. What could you say, just as a cautionary tale to those individuals who I described?
Cautionary tale, parents, you know, they say we're not supposed to be our child's friends. Like we're, you know, you hear that sometimes as a youth from an adult. I'm not your friend, I'm your parent. But in a way, you're both, and you have to be. You have to open up to your children in order for your children to relate to you. Don't forget where you came from and what it took to think. You know, there's a lot of parents out there that it's like you run your child away and you wouldn't realize what your child might be going through that you could have saved by just, prime example, all right, my daughter at one point, dad, can I have this? Dad, can I have that? Instead of the no, what I did one day was I told my daughter, I said, get a pen and paper. And I'm somebody that budgets bills. I put down everything, itemize everything that I got to pay. And I put the cost next to it. So I told her to itemize this list. And then I gave her my check. And I said, show me how do I pay this out of this. And she looked and she was like, wow, you got more bills than you have in your check. I said, exactly.
Wow.
So that was time for me to, it opened up a window for me able to teach her, one, to budget. Two, at the top of that list was always tithes. So she saw that I always paid tithes out of my thing.
That so many people may not know it's our return up to 10% an offering, right?
An offering.
To the local church, correct.
To the local church. She got to see and learn that. Then as well, I taught her about residual income. The fact that me having tenants and property also subsided as income to show. You know what I'm saying?
Nice.
So in return, it made my daughter to this day. When she stopped with the, if she needed something, she had asked. But it was never that, can I? But it turned my daughter into a go-getter herself. While in college, she maintained two jobs, even though she didn't have to. And I kept telling her she didn't have to. No, it's all right, Dad, I got it. I said, I don't want nothing to sting you from your education and stuff. I got it. She maintained two jobs, as well as she became the head of her sorority at the time. She was a Delta in college. She became she maintained two jobs and being the head of her chapter at her college, as well as, and still kept the AB average until she graduated. Right now, awesome. She's in nursing school doing the same thing. She'll work Amazon at night, McDonald's during the day, and still go to nursing school.
Wow.
Just so she can have her own thing. And like I said, it doesn't stop me from doing for her, and it still doesn't stop her from even coming to ask. But she learned the responsibility of money and what it's about. So I was glad that I showed her that instead of the no that my father used to tell me all the time. So try to talk to your kids, be a part of their lives, because you know there's certain things that you can just, instead of just saying no, and just you got to take that no and go. And because trust me, it's a different time and a different space in life where you have to. If you don't, you will lose your child to the streets. Kids in the streets, ain't nothing out there that you can't work a 9-to-5 and get, that you can't get, that you will get from hustling. It's the same, money is money. Things that you work hard, I learned that everything that I did negative never lasted financially. Everything that I did, because you don't appreciate the money. The stuff that I worked for and earned is the stuff that I kept. The stuff that I hustled for or got free-handed was the stuff that I lost. I have everything, the same stuff that I gained and acquired while hustling that I lost is the same things I gained and acquired while working that I still keep. There's nothing out there. You always hear the terminology, all that glitters, I hate when I get brain freeze.
It's not gold.
It's not gold.
Yeah.
Certain things are only temporary. A lot of things are temporary. Fashion comes and goes. The crazy thing, and I used to hear my pop say that all the time. And it's not until now that I realized what he was trying to tell me. Because the same things that I had and was in style for my era, partially was in style for his era, and is in style now for my children's era. So it all comes back full circle or whatever. But, and you keep running behind fashion for no reason. Back to the kids. A lot of y'all run to these gangs for protection, for me, for me. Learn that. Because there's no loyalty amongst the gangs. In life, you're meant to have one best friend. You're blessed if you have two. I could count on, I've knew thousands and ran with thousands and hundreds in my era. I could count on one hand how many people I speak to during the week. Like I said, there's no loyalty amongst them. In jail, I've watched leaders at the time when Rikers still had the box and it was a different culture of what was going on when we had control. I've watched leaders come to me in the hallway like, yo, H, what can I give you? So that like the boxes solitary confinement, which they think. So during the summer, that was the worst place to be, especially during the heat and everything else. So anytime that they would get what they call jail charges, tickets and stuff like that, you would have to do solitary confinement as a punishment. The guys hated that. So these guys would literally, I watched leaders of Bloods, leaders of Crips, leaders of 5%ers, mother, you name it, come to me or my peers and be like, yo, what can we give you so we don't gotta do 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, whatever the amount of days they had to do in the box, they would give up their own peers. So whether there was a banger in the house, which was a razor or whatever, it's a weapon that they were hiding, they'll tell you exactly where it's at. Whoever had the stash on the hooch, which was the jail toilet liquor that was made, they'll tell you that. Whoever had the weed, they'll tell you that. They'll tell you that there's no loyalty. And this is Blood telling on Blood, Crip telling on Crip. They would tell on their own peers. I watched this. And they came to me. So there's no loyalty out there. I've watched dudes turn on each other for the slightest thing, whether it was for girls or for money, whether it was for whatever. There's no loyalty amongst them. Find you a good friend that's your friend and keep that friend. But you don't need to be running. I know a lot of people, they run to gangs because they don't have the love that they need or they feel, or a lot of dudes are scared, period. So that's how they ended up in these gangs and stuff like that, or following people. Don't be a follower, be a leader. Because people will lead you around down the wrong track. You know, I found that growing up, you know, I used to have dudes that I ran with, but I was always a ringleader. At the end of the day, we would all go, yo, let's go do this, let's go do that. Blah, 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 blah. All right, let's go. I'm the ringleader. I'm going to do whatever I got to do. At the end of the day, I'm the one still getting in trouble, while the same people that was calling for me, yo, let's go do this, never got into no trouble. Never bust, what we would call never bust a grape. Never raised a hand, never whatever. Just pure lip service, like this Randy Mouth talk, and live off of everybody else's credibility, as I would say.
Right.
A lot of dudes, a lot of people be fronting in life for no reason.
Powerful nuggets, Jules. I think you've also told us that parenting is probably one of the most challenging and difficult jobs in the world. Could you share a little bit about your family and ways for people to contact you? And thank you so much again, bro, for all the nuggets, man.
My family, I mean, just like any other family, you have your ups and your downs. I like I said, you could be a parent and be a friend to your child and raise them at the same time. Relate to your child. I got on social media only to keep up with what was going on with these kids. You got to keep up with what your kids are doing, because you will lose them to the streets if you don't take the time out to sit down, talk with them, pray with them, guide them in the proper direction. Just don't just give orders or just, you know, talk to your kids. Spend time with your kids. I go riding with my kids. I go to the gym with my kids. I go on trips and vacations. I do all that so that they will have memories and they will relate to you. And the funny thing about it, depending on who's around your kids, a lot of their parents might not have the same situations going on in their homes. There's so many children that call me uncle or godfather, because guess what? They can't talk to their own parents, but they'll sit down and talk to me because they know that they can talk to me. It will stay with me. I can give them proper advice, proper guidance.
Right.
I've actually even been the mediator between certain kids and their parents because they couldn't talk directly to the kids, and it actually helped the relationship of that home and that child. So you don't need your kid. Your kids shouldn't have to run to nobody else. They should be able to run to you for whatever and talk to you for whatever. But if you're not that parent, all right, find somebody that will mediate for you, because the kids need that. Because if they don't get it from you, they're going to get it from somebody else. And the person you don't want them getting it to is from a cop or somebody that's telling them what to do in a jail setting and so on, so on.
Powerful, bro. I want to give you the opportunity to give your family a shout out as well.
Shout out to my wife, my son, my daughter. You know who you are. I love you all to death. I pray that we all make it to the kingdom. You know that is my prayer. Every day I pray for my kids to be leaders and not followers, to do what's right, to excel in their schoolwork, their talents, and everything else. These are the things that I pray over my kids that I suggest that you pray over your kids. Raise them up, like I said, in the right way. Mm-hmm. They won't depart. I mean, they'll drift, but everybody drifts. But what you put in is what will come back out eventually.
A lot of nuggets, Jules. Bro, thank you so much. You know, again, I mentioned to listeners that you and I have done the panels. I'm hoping if you have a need in your civic center or church, faith community, for someone to give you some insight on ways to keep your young people grounded, and as a parent, caregiver, guardian, etc., you're wanting to help them avoid some of the traps, Jules Hudson is a good guy to have, and he's willing to share. We kept a lot out, obviously, because of time constraints, but Jules is willing to share with you from a number of perspectives, not only as he's indicated with his history in the industry, but also where he is currently serving in the criminal justice system. So you'll be able to get a whole lot of nuggets and a lot of varying perspectives. Jules, thank you so much for joining me again on the What a Word podcast. I look forward to the rest of your journey. Blessings to you and your family, bro.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me. I'm honored. I'm humbled for, you know, even being asked to think. I look at myself as a normal, regular person as well. So, but like you said, I'm here for those that might need advice, somebody to talk to, somebody to relate to. I've been through it all, and it's only God's grace that brought me to where I'm at right now, which I'm thankful. So I'm always willing to share and give back.
Appreciate it, bro. Thank you so much, man. And we'll catch up. Blessings to you and your family.
Blessings to you as well, brother.
All right, take care, man.
Peace. You know, they say we're not supposed to be our child's friends. Like, we are aware, you know, you hear that sometimes as a youth from an adult. I'm not your friend, I'm your parent. But in a way, you're both. And you have to be. You have to open up to your children in order for your children to relate to you. Don't forget where you came from and what it took.